Hello and welcome along to another episode of the Glow West podcast, where we talk about sex, sexuality and the body. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and I'm delighted to be a part of the Tortoise Shack Network, where you can find all sorts of cultural and political podcasts, and of course, this sex podcast. Today, my guest is a killer, but not in the traditional sense, at least as far as I know. I'm chatting today with one of the founders of Gender RIP, which is a collaboration between Davin McKeown, Albert Savorio, Rial Murphy, and a loosely associated collection of gender killers based in Dublin, Ireland. They're a trans-led art collective creating spaces for trans people to exist and show their work. Their collective has worked with the RHA Gallery, Temple Bar Gallery and Studios, A4 Sounds and Quarter Block Party Festival in Cork. Albert is a trans non-binary Honduran artist based in Ireland. They're a sex educator, documenter and co-director of Gender RIP. They mostly work with analogue photography and moving image, which explores trauma, sexuality and the trans diaspora. Albert is also an avid writer and their creative writing and poetry often feeds into their visual pieces. And just a heads up for anyone that we will be talking a little bit about sexual violence in this podcast. Albert, thanks for coming along today. How are you?
Good. It feels so funny to hear all these things about myself. I'm like, that's me.
You've done a lot. You are busy.
So I am a busy bee.
You are a busy pink bee. Obviously people can't see, but you are a very pink person.
I'm a very pink person, yeah.
That's kind we like, don't worry about it. Now, so let's talk about the killer thing. You're not a normal killer, you are a gender killer. Talk to us about what that means.
I mean, we could be killers, but maybe we're just like really good and we don't but I feel like if I was, that would be a really bad move to tell people.
Yeah, like so, Fight Club, don't tell anyone.
Yeah, so Gender RIP was kind of born out of buying domains. Like, we all really like to buy, Davin specifically really likes to purchase domains. And .rip was a new one. We were like, oh, okay, well, obviously it's meant to be for, like, rest in peace. And we were like, you know, gender.rip, yeah. Like, rest in peace gender. We killed gender. And obviously, I think if you're listening to Glow West, you're familiar with the idea as gender as a construct, as gender as something that can be, that was created and therefore can be destroyed, can be killed. And it just kind of happened. And then we were like, well, what do we call ourselves? If gender.rp is a group, who are we? And then the concept kind of came up of we're killing gender because we're all trans. And I think that some people might see it as a contradiction because, you know, when you're trans, you're moving, you're going towards your gender identity, to match your physical and social appearance to your correct gender identity. If we're destroying gender, then that shouldn't really be a problem. But also everybody in our grower group are non-binary. So it's kind of hard as well to kill gender when you don't really have one.
So yeah, it's really conceptual. Getting complicated.
It's very conceptual. So we're just going to leave it at gender constructed, therefore gender can be killed.
Okay, awesome. Well, you can see how that's confusing to a lot of people.
Absolutely.
So you said you describe yourself as both trans and non-binary.
Yes.
So how does that work? How do those two identities interact with each other?
So the way that we define transness is, first of all, the acknowledgement that transness itself is a colonial subject. There's colonialism in defining the gender and binary of male and female. So it's to explain the process to which somebody simply isn't the gender that they were assigned at birth. So it's a very broad description because we accept people who don't want to medically transition or do want to medically transition, or people who don't want to legally transition, or whatever way of transitioning suits them. And then I would say that I'm non-binary because my gender doesn't really exist within male or female. And we really like to think of gender as a universe. So gender, maybe the sun is female and the Venus is male. And then you have all these other planets. It's not necessarily A and B, but rather a whole experience. And then you have all the dark void matter. I feel like that's me.
Okay. And that's the undefinable, mysterious matter.
Mysterious matter. And also I like the idea of stars as gender because it's like huge balls of energy. And I love that, rather than like, oh, well, masculinity is this. It's like, oh, yeah, masculinity is gaseous. There's gases in Venus. There's acidity. Like, why can't we use these words to describe gender instead?
Yeah, I definitely know some acid types.
Oh, yeah, the for line. Sure.
But you mentioned their colonial gender. So talk to us about that, because people are, I think, beginning to be a bit more aware of colonial histories. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a good few hundred years late in learning a lot about how, you know, Western white civilization has colonized the world and impacted, I suppose, impacted on how people define themselves. So you have conversations about two spirits, you know, and there's like multiple genders all around the world, but of course in Western Europe was essentially, no, you've got two, you've got no universe, you've got A and B and that's it. So what the legacy, I'm sure, of colonial implications on gender must be a negative one, as absolutely an understatement.
So I think a really well documented example of colonial gender being literally enforced, there's a collection of photos that you can actually access through the National Gallery of Photography and their archive, where it's these Christian Irish missionaries who would go, I think it was to Papua New Guinea, and they would literally make people, like men, what they considered men as a man wearing pants, and they would force the women or what they thought were women to wear skirts, and then they would photograph them and be like, wow, look at these now civilized indigenous people. And it's like, what? Like, these people before had no conception of gender in such a way that it meant such rigid matters. And that's not to say that indigenous tribes don't have their own rigid traditional roles, but they might not be necessarily associated with gender more than function. So perhaps like it's a spiritual more of a spiritual role in your community than you're a man or a woman, but you're the spiritual person. This is the person who cooks. This is the more functional. And I think that it's also really interesting that all of the colonial places then have a lot of transphobia and have a lot of homophobia because of the colonial legacy that stripped away all of those original beliefs. And I really mean stripped away, because it was a really violent act. And especially with the Catholic Church in Latin America, you have burnings of sacred books. And it's the idea that, oh, well, the Mayans didn't have written language and all of this. And it's like, no, they literally burnt everything.
Yeah. Like, that's where we have things like aliens built the pyramids and everything in South America. It's like, no. The church just ruined everything.
Yeah, they wasn't aliens. Set everything on fire. And I think about that a lot, because there's so much knowledge that I think is still passed on verbally through indigenous tradition, but that we should all have access to without having to have them burned. But I think that it's really hard, because then you have the West then realizes, oh, maybe homophobia was bad. Maybe transphobia wasn't good. And they decide that transness is a thing. And that's not to say that trans people didn't exist before colonialism in the West, but to say that the identity of being trans is only constructed as a result of colonizing other countries. So we do recognize that within Gender to RIP, because we've worked with several Indigenous artists, and we're very much aware that it is not, like, transness is not reflective of a worldwide experience of gender. But I think that because we are based in Ireland, because we have experienced that experience, we can't deny that experience. And it's not to say that it's bad, because I don't want somebody to listen to this and be like, oh my God, I'm a colonizer for being trans. Because that's not the case. It's more about understanding where that's coming from and understanding the privilege that is rooted in being able to identify as trans and the history that is behind that.
And in Honduras, you know, what's the situation like there? Is it the case of using that Western approach of saying that there's trans people, or is it more the indigenous approach, or is it a mix of everything?
So there's a lot of indigenous silencing in Honduras and in most of Central America, but the Catholic Church is balls deep in Central America. And there is absolutely no corner of most Central America that you will find that isn't Christian. And we have a lot of Protestant versus Catholicism as well. So that was something that I found really interesting when I came here, that I was like, oh, you have the same thing.
Yeah, you can relate to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I can relate to my friend. I was actually saying to somebody that I always felt like a double agent because I went to a Protestant school, but I was raised Catholic. So I was like, I was both in the choir of the church, of the Catholic church, but in the worship band of the Protestant school.
Oh, so double agent.
Dipping my toes. Yeah. But unfortunately, because the Catholic church has such a grip on, especially in Honduras, it's just like trans people are just not a thing. And it's like really, really difficult because overall, we have a large scale of violence that is state purpose as well as gang fueled. And most of the killings are usually women and trans women in particular. So we have high rates of trans murders and queer murders. And there's no legal recognition of queer people at all. And even with like trying to change your name, even if you're a cisgender person, you're not legally allowed to unless your name is hard to pronounce or there was like a spelling mistake in your name.
And so very restrictive.
Really, really, really restrictive. And you can't, there's no such thing as changing your gender on any kind of document, like at all.
So trans people either stay silent or emigrate or end up murdered. Like,
yeah,
Jesus.
Basically. And there is quite a thriving community of trans women. They have their own Miss Honduras, but it's like Miss Trans Honduras. So all the participants are trans. And honestly, I live for that event because the photos are great. They all get their dues done. They all look fantastic.
Nice.
But very, very little trans masculine people. And I actually attended the Festival of Human Rights in Trinity College last year. I don't remember what time of the year it was at, but they had they've done like a LGBTQIA around the world, and they had a trans man from Honduras, and I was so shocked. I was like, where did you find him? Jesus, how can I contact this man?
Like pushing people out of the way to get
literally,
to him.
I was like, oh my goodness, hello? And it was such an eye opener for me that I was like, wow, obviously I knew we exist, but it makes such a difference to actually see somebody else like you from where you are, like grew up how you talk. And as much as I love my trans community here, like it's not the same.
Yeah, of course.
And it's really nice to be able to find other people, even if it's just knowing that they exist.
Well, you've done something super positive with all that trauma, as well as much as you can, process all of that. But you turn that into art. So you've connected, a lot of your art connects the ideas of trauma, identity and sexuality. So what does that look like? What mediums do you use? What do you produce? What are your topics?
I think there's a variety of trauma that is dealt with, unfortunately, and it's not just like, oh, this flavor of trauma.
Here's my one singular trauma, and that is it.
Yeah, no, I wish. It's unfortunately just like, here's the web, you can untangle it, up to you. But the first trauma related job or work that I was doing within my practice was to do with sexual violence. So I've been through different forms of sexual violence, because I think there's different degrees to sexual violence. And that's not to say that one is worse than the other, but rather they all create different experiences. And I realized after I started going to therapy that there was nothing like group therapy available for any kind of experience of sexual violence. And I decided I was going to undertake a project where I wanted to physically connect people in their locality to meet and just to talk and just to be aware of each other's spaces, but also to create a kind of web, because I think a lot of the things that inspire my practice are related to water and the ocean. And I really think about nets, and that's where the textile aspect came in for me, because I created a call out, and I was like, hey, are you a survivor of sexual violence? Do you want to have a chat with people around your area? Come meet me and let me take your photos. And I took photos of people, we all had a chat. We went to my house. I used to live in Stony Batter at the time. I had like 10, 15 people in my room at once drinking tea, like literally all of us bawling our eyes out. People for the first time in their lives admitting that they'd been assaulted or that they'd had some kind of experience of violence. And it was such a, I wish I could like bring people into that room and that creating that, physically creating that space to be together and to create a network of sexual assault survivors that are together and know that people are there to have their back. So then we went out to fields around us and took photos of people holding hands, and we tried to physically make networks. And then I embroidered all of the photographs together and made a net out of them. So that's kind of, that was like the first work that I did.
That sounds gorgeous.
And I actually really want to go back to it because I kind of stopped because I had heart surgery. And so that was, that kind of put me out of service for a while. And it is something that I want to go back to because I think that there's so much room for community-driven protection and accountability about our experiences of sexual violence. But I mainly also do photography, so that's kind of how I link the two. And I do analog photography, as you mentioned. And I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to stave every sexual assault survivor in Ireland.
You would be quite busy.
I would be very busy.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize how prevalent it is. Like the amount of people who messaged me was astounding. And I didn't get to go through everybody because of scheduling issues. But the main idea was to meet in a space, which most of the time was my room in Stony Batter, make tea for people and have the chats and just like physically creating a network of support and of knowing, hey, you have other people who've been through the similar thing as you. And most of us didn't have the same experiences, but it was still, I think, that experience of being taken away something or your choice being taken away. And this is also like while repeal was happening, I think. So I think it was quite prevalent that this was like, oh, we're all getting our choices taken away. And then we would go to a field or any open space and try to physically make a net with our bodies and hands. And then I had the photos printed. And I embroidered the photos together. So I was embroidering people's hands, and the joints where people touched were different colors. And then I embroidered all of them together, making a net. So in a way that it's one holistic body. So it is like one big network. That was the whole idea. And it was called La Red, which is just the network and the net in Spanish. And there was a series of texts written, like poems as well.
That just sounds lovely and nurturing and just another way to create language, because I know sexual assault and sexual trauma, you know, sometimes it takes people such a long time to even name it to themselves and even to try find the right language. And, you know, the whole like, oh, it's not rape if it's not, you know, hardcore violent or whatever stereotype Absolutely. Is there. There's so many different forms, and therapy doesn't work for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard that from so many people and they're like, oh, I tried that, it didn't work. And you know, people carry that trauma around. So it's lovely to see yourself providing all those different avenues for people to access. And in the collaborative nature just sounds lovely. It's making me feel like all warm and fuzzy now.
Yeah,
so I can only imagine at the day, but it's just so lovely. It feels like that supportive nature of people around you. You don't have to explain, like they know, they get it because they've been there. And so you're not starting from scratch. So I think it's just such a lovely, I suppose, like, it's person-centered, isn't it? It's not like, here's my, like, list of how I'm going to solve your trauma. It's just people actually coming together themselves and telling their story, which is sadly rare, you know,
sometimes. And I think I didn't really want to center myself in it. And, like, there's nobody's faces in it. It's just our bodies. Because I think that we all deserve some anonymity as well to exist as a body together of a network. But it, as you were saying, some people will take years to figure out that they were assaulted, that something was wrong. And I think that in particular with the recent few years of Me Too and people talking more about openly about experiences of sexual violence, people are realizing, oh my God, I've actually had experiences of sexual violence. So it's really lovely to be able to create those spaces. And something that I've really... that I think, I don't know if there's real numbers about it because it's not that I don't believe in statistics. I love statistics, but I think that it's really hard with marginalized groups sometimes, because we might not have access to, like, where are these statistics coming from? Where I'm getting to is the fact that there's a lot of sexual violence that happens to trans people. And that can be because of whether you're, say, you're kicked out of your house. What are you going to do? You're going to be on the streets. You might get sexually assaulted if you're homeless. Regardless of whether you're trans or not. Yeah, it's quite a vulnerable position to be in. Medical professionals sometimes can take advantage. And in general, there's a lot of power dynamics when you're like coming out as trans. Because I think there's still a lot of sexual violence within the community as well. And then when I was doing my next project, I was like, wait, I would like to do something that focuses on the joy. Because as much as there is trauma, it's like acknowledging that trauma and creating space for joy is so important to me.
It's so important, yeah.
And also really important for gender.rip, because I really think that as much as we're like, oh yeah, we platform artists and we do performance nights, we do exhibitions, it's great to get artists paid, to get artists to get more audiences, but it's also, we need to create the spaces where we can really be trans, really be queer, really just exist without having to pay, without having to worry about how long you have to be there. Do I have enough materials to make art, to draw something? Because so many trans people are in such precarious situations a lot of the time that we really aim to create spaces and pockets of joy.
And joy is—it's so important. Like, it's the same with academic studies. We only focus on the negative sometimes, you know, rather than look at like the lovely aspects of sex, which is the whole point of sex.
Absolutely.
You know, it's
really
meant to have pleasure. That's the point.
You know, I mentioned earlier that I was brought up Catholic, and something that actually there was way more sexual repression on the Protestant side. But the Catholicism that I was kind of taught was that sex is good and sex is great only when you're married.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Of course.
That qualifier is always
there. That's a very important qualifier. Like, you cannot have it absolutely no way before you're married. But when you're married, that shit is good.
Yeah. Well, over here it was like, no, it's just for procreation.
No, over there it's like, oh, you know, sex is so good. Like, there's no reason sex wouldn't be so good if God didn't want you to have it. And it's like, yeah, how can you deny that? But then it's like, well, I want to have it.
Oh, we did not get that version. Well, I didn't get that version over here. So, well, that sounds like a lot more fun.
It certainly was, but also it was really confusing because I was like 14 and I was like, well, why am I horny? Like, I'm not supposed to be horny until I'm married. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I don't want to get married at 14.
Yeah,
so
sorry, God.
What's going on?
Actually, now that I think about it, that makes sense in like the Bible sense, you know, because women were married at like 14 years of age.
That's
true.
I'm like,
oh, okay.
There you go. We've solved everything.
We solved Catholicism.
There we go. We're legends. Well, you did artwork in last year as a tune last year on transgender desirability.
Yes.
And that's something, even those two words together are so rare. It's either because the stories we hear about trans people are generally just ones of trauma or they're being fetishized. Do you know?
Exactly.
And like you look at porn sites and it just the awful words that are there and the way trans people are described, it's just disgusting. But so talk to me about transgender desirability, that project, and what went on in that.
So that was kind of born out of I think that's where I was trying to go with the sexual assault stuff. So a lot of trans people that I know, and I know a lot of trans people, and everybody had some kind of like, well, we don't have any space to just really be yourself and really be expressive because you will get some kind of violence. And I was like, I would love to do a photo shoot of trans people being hot. And originally I really wanted to do like a proper boudoir, like delicious sensual shots, but I'm a broke person. So therefore I was like, I cannot afford this right now. So that is still in the back burner. That will happen. And then I was like, well, what if I let people do it with things they have themselves? So I wanted to people tell me what is desirability to them? What makes them feel hot? What makes them feel, what is gender euphoric to them? And that's something that like we particularly focus on gender dysphoria, which is I actually was trying to find a definition for this the other day, And it's kind of like the feeling that something's missing, or that there's something wrong with your body. It's just not right. And it's like a physical pain almost. You can feel it. It's in, and it's all over the body. But gender euphoria is when something happens and it makes you feel more happy in your gender and more realized, and like thinking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, self-fulfilled, that you're your gender and you are this person. And I absolutely was just like, I want to focus on that. I don't want to focus on dysphoria, because no shade to any artist out there, but there's enough works of like skinny white trans people with an ACE bandage on it. And also, do not bind with ACE bandages. They're so bad for you. Please contact, like, there are places who will get you a free binder. Do not, that is my thing about binding. Do not buy ACE bandages. And I just really wanted to create space for these people to really capture that euphoria and like those feelings of desirability, because I really think there's so much power in seeking pleasure in your everyday life, and seeking pleasure and desire in your gender, in your person, because I think it makes life so much more fun and so much more fulfilling when you find the pleasure in the little things.
Absolutely. Like, life is short, you know, and it's like that sex should be all about pleasure rather than trauma, and so should gender. Everyone should be happy in themselves. And it is, you know, how was the reactions to that? I know you wasn't part of the Fringe Festival, but it was part of a wider exhibition.
Yeah, so it was part of Palace Projects, those artist initiated projects. And we applied as a group called the Queeratorial. So it was curated by Aoife Banks, who is an NCAD graduate, and that's how I met her. And it was a bunch of queer artists. So it was really nice that it was like, okay, this isn't necessarily like, oh, you're the one queer artist in this exhibition, but rather everybody was the queer artist. So that was really lovely. I actually had a lot of people tell me that they really loved the photos, but I also thought that although the photos I think are beautiful in themselves, I did have little text with them as well that I asked each person to write, because I was like, I want you to tell people what it feels to be hot for you. And some people really reacted really well to that as well. And I didn't really see any negative things, but I think it's also because it was a small enough exhibition that I think our fellow friends of the far right didn't get to see them. Yeah.
They don't deserve that.
They don't deserve that, because they've definitely targeted me before with other sexuality work. And for anti-racism work. So I was like, you do not get to see my art. Please do not target my art.
Yeah. And what do you think that is? Because I know, like, we've both experienced that targeting of people who are determined not to let other people speak about sex, especially in a public context. Do you think it is just fear underneath everything? Have you stripped it back down? Or do you think that there's something else there that, because it's just, it's pervasive, you know, it's in like so many countries. We see what's happening in Poland at the moment, and Hungary, and the US as well. And it is here in Ireland.
The UK.
As well. The UK is just a disaster.
Oh my God. I honestly think that, I don't know if it's a fear, but fear of losing power. Because I think in order to say, no, racism doesn't exist, no, transphobia doesn't exist, you're dismissing that you have power. And I think a lot of people are really uncomfortable with even acknowledging that they have any kind of power. And I think that far right people are really smart, because they know who to target and they know how to target them. And it's not the first time that this has been done. So I feel like they're using really old rhetorics, which I'm just like, wow, that they just keep on giving. But it's ultimately, I think a lot of things about bigotry are rooted in power and not wanting to lose power, because I think that a lot of people just fear having to be treated how they treat other people. And it is I do find it really sad, and I am definitely a believer of restorative justice and transformative justice. So I do think that at some point, hopefully, these people can redeem themselves. I'm not going out of my way to do that work myself. But no, no, they've done enough damage, I think.
Since Alex, yeah.
But it has to be self-led. Like, they have to seek for that kind of knowledge. And it can be really hard. And, you know, I often think about my own journey, my own political journey, because I was really anti-abortion. I was like, we will not talk about sex. Even though I was really interested in sex, I was like, no, that is shameful, disgusting. Abortion is disgusting. And I was always like, well, gays maybe deserve rights. And here I am, a big flaming homo.
That's some journey that you've been on.
Journey. And I remember the first time somebody was like, oh, well, you got to think about the mother too. And I was just like with abortions. And I was like, excuse me? I never even thought of that. And I was maybe like 13, 14. And I was like, wow, that just blew my mind. It blew my mind. And,
that's huge.
And, you know, that was a long time ago, but maybe they've just never been exposed to that. Maybe they've never had that. And maybe they will. Actually, there's quite a few sex workers that I follow online that their job is to kind of dom bigots out of their bigotry.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few people. Well, like, look at the, you know, this stereotype of the Republican politician who has, you know, their escorts come into the office, mm-hmm. and things like that. It's very hypocritical.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I do kind of find pleasure in, like, seeing these beautiful black femmes with, like, a white man, like, licking their feet. I'm like, delicious. Delightful.
Yeah. Isn't it, like, the context of that?
The context of that, else, I'm just so, like, yeah. Chef, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, you know, I know the repeal movement, which is, you know, the push for abortion rights.
Speaking of domming.
Speaking of damning, yeah, no, that's a whole other podcast. We'll bring you back for that one. You know, I know you were one of the more vocal voices about how white and cis focused the repeal movement was in Ireland, and how, you know, it really caused a lot of harm to minorities and to trans people. So do you think we've learned from that? Or are we, you know, because we're now having conversations about Black Lives Matter, and I know that some people who would have been very pro repeal are maybe a bit slower to come to that table than we would like.
I don't think that there's been that much progress, but we are absolutely progressing in some stuff, because if last year you told me we were having conversations about abolition, I would have been like, no way. Absolutely no way. And I'm so happy that we're leading conversations on abolition and on race, because they need to be had. And Ireland is so behind on race conversations with everywhere in the world. And I think it's understandable. Like, Ireland as a state is fairly new. You've only had about 100 years to catch your stuff. You're still catching up on all your Catholic shame and guilt. Fair enough. But that's not an excuse for racism. I think that it's been really difficult, and actually throughout the whole repeal thing, it was really hard, and I was really happy to find a group like Merge, Migrants and Ethnic Minorities for Reproductive Justice, in order to kind of find my people and be like, hey, we also felt left out of this. And it's similar to marriage equality, I feel, that those most marginalized and those most difficult to be understood were pushed under the rug, which were trans people and bisexual people. And then during the repeal thing, it was anybody who's not a white, middle-class white woman who just had an accident. And obviously, like, that happened. But there's so many other types of even types of women, without even getting to cis people, without getting sure, out of cisness. So much class issues, rural issues, access to, oh my God. So many people got left behind, and they had a march called No One Left Behind, and No One Left Behind, but they didn't ask anybody from, like, migrant women, and then one of the people they had was like a SWERF, a sex worker exclusionary radical feminist, and I was like, that's not great. And then they also didn't have any trans people, and maybe like 2 or 3 days before I got asked to do it. And I was just like, yeah, that's real, real inclusive, yeah, real diverse.
Tokenism.
Yeah. Yeah. And I gave a speech that I don't think a lot of them liked. because I've never been invited back to any of those spaces. But I'm
well, they don't sound very inclusive from the get-go, so.
And you know, I'm neurodivergent, so I don't have a filter. I will say things how they are, and a lot of people don't like that, and I think that's fair enough, but I just can't not say things how they are. Like, if something's wrong, I'm going to say that it's wrong. And maybe it's also a morality thing that I'm like, this is an issue. But I think that we really, people, like white settled people, really need to give space for all the different types of marginalized groups that need support right now and that need to be leading the conversations. But I'm also afraid of, because I think white feminism is something that you don't have to be white to do it.
Because
because there can be you can be a person of color, you can be a trans person and still support things that oppress other things, other people, other groups less marginalized than you. And I think that that's comes again to the power thing. I am happy that we're having these conversations, but it's just very exhausting that we're at a point where we're starting. It's like, what's racism? What's racism in my house, in my Ireland? Yes, actually.
Well, that's when we looked a lot at what happened in the States and we were like, oh, that's terrible over there. And everyone's like, well, actually, let's also look at Ireland and see what's happening here. And there's some groups that people will be openly racist about, you know, people like travelers. It's apparently acceptable, which is obviously ridiculous. But yeah, we still have to have a lot of conversations about that. I think people think of racism as migrant groups. And migration is new enough to Ireland, you know, relatively speaking.
I understand that,
But it's, there's so much work to be done. But in your ideal world then of education, do you think that work gets done in schools, you know, from a very young age? You know, what's your ideal way to address racism? How big a question is that? Sorry, that's a huge question.
Let me just fix the
I
world.
Can hear my brain walking away with that and I was like, that's ridiculous. Even as I was saying it, I was like, sorry.
I think that
tell me all the answers for everything. Sorry.
42.
Yeah. But that's actually quite a good example there of, like, you know, being blind on feminism. I just asked you to solve everything when it should be like, how can I as a white person, you know, contribute my part to this?
Yeah.
And that's really what the conversation needs to be a lot of the time.
Exactly. And I think that that's something that a lot of people are like, oh my God, how can I be a good white person? And it's like, first of all, let's dismantle whiteness, because whiteness holds a lot of power. Whiteness holds a lot of resources, monetary resources and physical resources, like space. People don't think of space as a resource, and land. And in Ireland, we don't, although we do have colonization, it's like a different colonization of land. But I think that the first thing is accepting that it's an issue that seems to be a difficult thing for many people here in Ireland. But I think that people need to understand that it's not about morality, because in Ireland in particular, I find that people associate racism and transphobia. I think racism is the one that people get really defensive about, because they're like, I'm not a bad person, how dare you? It seems like an attack on your person. It's fine. We're all, by Western culture, taught to be racist. I wouldn't say that I'm completely not a racist person, because I was brought up with a bunch of really racist stereotypes and really racist things every day. And it's more about being anti-racist, I think, and trying to tackle that on every aspect. I don't think schools need to, I mean, obviously schools should have like anti-racist things, but I think that everything should be affected-led. So not have like, oh, here's some white person talking about this non-white thing. And I think that...
Yeah. I'm getting money for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the problem that I have with NGOs, that it's like, I'm going to be the white savior. First of all, let's abolish NGOs with white cisgender settled people. They're like, I'm going to speak for all the poor people that don't have access to talk. It's like, we can talk. You have things to say. We've been talking. So I think there's a lot of shutting up and listening that needs to be done. And earnest listening. I always forget what's the difference between hear and listen. Hear is the one where you just like...
Yeah, you're just absorbing.
Yeah.
And active listening is...
Yeah.
Yeah, you're actually... listening down, and like absorbing
and understanding what is being said rather than just like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
I think that understanding that racism is a systemic problem is going to be really key for a lot of people doing anti-racist work, and rather than basing it on a morality issue.
And absolutely, and because no one likes to think, yeah, like you said, oh, I'm not a good person or whatever, but it's not even about that. It's conscious and unconscious and all, everything we do on that daily basis.
And it's similar with transphobia, that like we are, because of colonialism and because of growing up in the West, you're going to be brought up to be transphobic, plain and simple, because it's just so common and so prevalent. And it's work. It is work.
But and it's not that it's hard, but like if you look at like any, if you take a newspaper from today, even, I'm sure there's some kind of anti-trans piece in it that just seems to be, it's just such common, particularly in the British media. And then when you have Irish schools, which have Irish sex education that's really lacking, and you don't have conversations about trans people. I know on a different podcast we talked with Aoife and Noah about this as well, and just that lack of visibility as well. But you know, what you're doing with art is really interesting, because you're creating that different conversation and different accessibility, and again from a person who's lived that experience. So that's really important to use. Like your community as well, the gender RIP community as well, I think it's so important to have, and you've done so much as well in such period of time.
We have done a
Well, they're taking your lead because you're busy. So everyone is
busy
there. But even like, I was looking at your Instagram, and you've got that really cool drawing competition at the moment. Is it the collective? No, the Conspiracy Club.
Conspiracy Club,
So you've got things like frogs against fascism, which sounds awesome.
And against capitalism.
Yeah. And the, you had another one, was it, you had the Eat the Rich as well, but you've got really like, you're using humor as a really great tool in that aspect. So how is that drawing event going for you, and what's the response? Because frogs against fascism sounds pretty interesting.
I think we don't have enough frogs against fascism. I think we need more. I don't think we'll ever have enough frogs against fascism. It's just brilliant. It just really rolls off the tongue. I love,
it does.
I really love alliterations.
It totally works.
But currently we're actually doing as well, we're having online spaces where people can come and draw, because what we typically will do is we have a venue and we'll fully take over, so we'll fill it with love, tacky, like 90s vibes, so all the fake plants, all the fake rugs, disgusting bright pinks, bright yellows, neon colors everywhere. And then we have so many art supplies, and that's like one of the main things that we love, is to provide the crafts, and we will also provide food, water, tea. We're also very, not very strict, but most of our events are sober, and we really love to create that space. So it's been kind of hard to try to create it online, but we are we are trying to do, because we can't physically give people things.
Yeah,
we're still trying to create that space, and I think humor is really, really key, especially for the drawing conspiracy. So the drawing conspiracy is originally comes from Dovin's work, so Dovin McKeown. So he did the drawing the gay drawing conspiracy in I always forget what's called, CDC, it's in San Diego, it's like the comic drawing convention, maybe.
Okay,
I actually don't know what it stands for, I just know that it's called CDC. But he did it in CDC maybe in 2014 in San Diego, I think it was, and then it's been kind of like, it's the idea has changed a little bit, but the main idea is kind of a reverse pyramid scheme, in the sense that the end result is friendship and community. So you start off, and your main things that you have to do is you've got to conspire. So usually we'll conspire about what does your dream neighborhood look like in The Sims? And you have to draw a plan for your dream neighborhood in The Sims. Or what does your neighborhood look like if there were no institutions around you? Where would you get food? Where would you do this? So we try to tease at those anti-capitalist ideas, anti-institution, but also having fun. When then the next thing could be like, draw frogs against fascism. What does that even mean? How do you draw a frog? How is a frog against fascism? And I also think it's kind of funny, because Pepe, the meme, the frog.
That's what I was thinking,
poor Pepe. He was such a beautiful meme. And then the fascists were like, I'm going to take it. And actually, the creator has said multiple times, he's like, I do not stand with fascism. So poor Pepe. And for Pride, we're doing closed spaces. So we're doing a trans-only space and we're doing queer space as well. And for those, we've tried to, like, we do explain, especially with drawing, there's such a hierarchy about drawing in art, in the art world. It's like, if you can't draw hyper-realistically, you're not a good drawer. And it's like, there's so many types of drawings and so many beautiful types of illustrations that are not hyper-realistic, and they're beautiful just as they are, and interesting and engaging.
Yeah. And it makes it very accessible.
It makes it really accessible. And we really also hate the category of, like, it's called other art, I think it's called. I should really know my terms. But anybody who has a mental illness is put into that category, because it's like, oh, you're not sound of mind, therefore you cannot be a good artist.
So it's not, like, real art?
Yeah, and it's not considered real
inverted
art.
Inverted commas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's very institutionalized that that's not real art. So if you have dementia or anything like that, no, that's not, sorry, that can't be considered regular art. And it's like, there's a hierarchy of drawing, and we really do not believe in that. We really want, anybody can draw, anybody can make art. And I think that also one of the reasons that Dolvin really believes in the Conspiracy Club is because we want to create spaces to actively be anti-capitalist in. Because when was the last time that you really sat down to do something that felt nice, that you're creating something without, how am I going to monetize this? Like, am I turning this hobby into something that will give me money out of necessity? Because it's like, oh, I need something to be productive, and productivity equals making money.
That's rare. Yeah. Like, so you're told rare. All the time, like, set up your Etsy shop with your bits and bobs. So.
And it's like, no, I just want to make some drawings. I just want to do some doodles. Mm. I just want to spend time in community, breaking bread amongst the comrades.
It's refreshing, because it is that, like, you know, you're measured by your productivity. And, you know, we saw that even with COVID, like, what's your lockdown hobby?
Oh,
have you monetized your life? And,
oh my God.
Know. Yeah. It's like people are just trying to rest. It was a pandemic. Like,
exactly.
Oh, you use textiles a lot as well in your work. And yes. I'm slightly obsessed myself with the idea of, like, how textiles can be used in storytelling and art. And I just think it's fascinating. And, you know, the very obvious example is drag, because that's, you know, the use of textiles to, you know, change something or tell a story. So how do you approach the use of textiles or gender RAP as a whole?
So as gendered RAP, we do teach the very basics of textiles, I guess, which is what Rian normally does. Rian is our resident textile expert. And guru, textile guru. And they'll teach people how to sew, how to embroider. We've taught people how to make patches. I can send you, I have the last patch I made is like a strap-on. So I'll send you a picture of that. And it's, I think that it can be a really fun thing, because especially we think about sewing and textiles as really feminine skills. And we really, like, they've been traditionally feminine, but they don't have to be. They're skills that everybody should have. Like, learning how to sew can be so helpful in your day-to-day life. We do recommend to learn how to sew. And then we, like, Brian's work is mostly through textiles. They do a lot of free stitching and free embroidery that's really beautiful, and explores, like, issues of transness and issues of sexual violence as well. And then with drag, we don't host that many drag nights, but we host performance events where people do a range of stuff. I do drag myself, and it's something that I really love, because I grew up doing all the, like, school plays and everything, and I loved it dressing up to tell a story and then being able to put it back off. And it's really fun, I think, as well, to explore with gender, because I would say that we definitely support more or have shown more non-traditional drag, in the sense that it's not like, I am a man, I am now dressed like a woman, but it's rather, I am a person and I have a bunch of glitter on my face and some makeup. It's beautiful.
Well, it's not like that stylized, polished drag that you might see on Drag Race or something.
Exactly. No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
For our last performance, we had somebody do a rendition of Memory from Cats. and they were saying that they wanted to reclaim cats for the gays. So
after
the terrible CGI film, and it was, oh my God, it was unbelievable. They were wearing just like a plain hoodie and a plain pants and like sneakers. And I was like, okay, I thought they were going to do a drag performance. And then they started like taking their thing off, and there was like all this like leopard print underneath and all this like storytelling. And then they had a face marker, and they did the whiskers on stage, put their little cat headband, and it was brilliant.
That sounds
amazing.
And
I was like, wow, how little clothing items as well can be used to tell a story. And it's really fun to create, I think, space where you can do whatever you want with drag rather than you have to do a lip sync to the song.
Yeah, or have a very expensive lace front wig to go with it.
Expensive. Expensive.
Yeah, like Euro shop wigs will have to do the job for now, unless you can make them. So awesome. Albert, like, you're amazing. I could talk to you all day. But this will be like a 15-hour podcast if we do.
This was the joke when we were like, oh, who do we send to talk? And it's like, oh, Albert will literally just talk for the whole hour. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, true.
That's, well, we did a panel a couple of years back for the Science Gallery.
Oh, yes, we would have stopped talking on porn.
Yeah. I mean, how much is there to say on porn? Like, that's going to be, that's an interesting thing. So, absolutely. Like, you know, the plan for Glow West is when we're allowed to socialize properly again to have some live events. So you're getting dragged up on stage for that with me.
I love talking.
That would be an extra long episode, but we will see on that one. So, come here. Where can people find you to continue this conversation?
So, to continue the conversation with Gendered RIP, we are gendered.rip. Literally, if you type into your website, gendered.rip will pop up on Facebook and Instagram, gendered.rip. And the only place we're not gendered.rip is on Twitter, because they won't allow you to have periods on your username. So gender rip.
That's really
very annoying when you have like a thing that is the same on everything else.
Yeah.
And my Instagram is Principite, so like little prince, but in Spanish, and removing the gender. So in Spanish, the gender is A and O for masculine and feminine. And a lot of people are trying to use the E as a gender neutral. So at Principite. And my Instagram and my Twitter are both that now, because somebody called Caroline told me that I should make sure that my brand is the same, and I was like, oh my gosh, she's right. I don't have nothing was the same.
Yeah, I have wise moments sometimes.
You do have wise moments. So that's where you can find us. Rian, I think, is Queerian on our Instagram, and Dovin doesn't use social media. In his own words, he's like an old man.
Okay, that's fair enough. And you have a Patreon as well?
We have a Patreon as well. You can choose your level of gender killer. So you can, so they all have different levels of genders and different levels of weapons to how you want to kill gender. So please subscribe. We have loads of events coming up. On the 25th, we're supporting our resident artist from A4 Sounds, Chris Hinojosa, for the launch of their show Liturgia. Which is online, so you have people have no excuse to not check it out. And we'll do some newsletters too.
Awesome. You're absolutely killing it. Pun very much intended.
Hey.
In that aspect, as a gender killer. Fantastic. Listen, Albert, thank you so much for chatting
with me
today.
Caroline.
It's been amazing. So and we need to catch up for a drink when we're allowed as well.
Absolutely.
So we'll do that. Awesome. Thank you all to my listeners for staying tuned. And again, if you like the podcast, please do pop over to iTunes and rate and review, because it really does help spread the word and helps other people find it as well. If you really, 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 really love the podcast, you can pop over and support us via Patreon, and that's at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And come find us on social media. Give away sex toys over on Instagram from time to time. That's at Glow West Insta. And over on Twitter, it's glow_west_ over there. And I look forward to chatting to you next time. Bye.